we stop there. We have a few emails. There's one from Dr. Sturry in Bern, Indiana. I've been listening and watching here in Indiana. I love my Greek New Testament. She recently gained a good scanned copy of Erasmus 1516 and 1520 New Testament, Stephanus 1550, Elsevier 1633, and the Competentia Potiphar, all in PDF files. We'll share these with you all. Well, that's good. I enjoy when you discuss the manuscripts and the old TR texts. However, I use my New King James, but compare it to my TBS TR text. Oh, we'll have to forgive me for that. We're still friends here, by the story. Dr. O'Wade also hears from a man in North Jersey. Which edition of the Greek received text is the KJV based upon? All right, that's based upon the Scribner's annotated Greek New Testament text. It's also published by the Trinitarian Bible Society. And that's the text that King James is based. In fact, he was told by the, asked by the University of Cambridge, since he was one of the translators of the English Revised Version, one of the ones on the committee, even though he fought with Westcott-Hort, the Cambridge University said, would you make up a Greek text that exactly mirrors the words underlying the King James Bible? He said yes, and so he did. And this is made up of that very thing. And so, and then he said, they also were told by the University of Cambridge, Cambridge University Press, to put in bold letters those places where the text receptus was changed by Westcott-Hort and the English Revised Version, which he did. That's why in bold black letters they have them. So that's what he did. That's the reason. So it's based upon Scripture's annotated Greek text. All right, let's continue then in our talk about the English, the Westcott-Hort's Greek text that they refuted by Dean Berg on this booklet here. Dean Berg said, what else must be the result of this? All this of general uncertainty, confusion, and distress. A hazy mistrust of all scriptures has been insinuated in the hearts and minds of countless millions. We mentioned that as we left. Now we get into Lachmann. You mentioned Lachmann and Titchendorf and Trigelis and Griesbach. Lachmann's ruling principle, and notice, was exclusive reliance on a very few ancient authorities because they were ancient. That's the only reason. Very few. Because he constructed his text on three or four, not infrequently on one or two Greek codices. Of the Greek fathers, he relied on Origen, who was a Gnostic. Of the oldest versions, he cared only for the Latin. To the Syrian, he paid no attention. We venture to think his method irrational. Now, he's going to discuss Lachmann, Titchendorf, Griesbach, Westcott-Hort, different methods of these early men that were textual critics. So, very few manuscripts. Trigelis, now he's the one that's the Christian. He's the one that's the born-again Christian, and he followed these false teachers on the wrong text. Trigelis adopted the same strange method. He resorted to a very few of the entire mass of ancient authorities for the construction of his text. He proceeded as exactly that. His proceeding is exactly that of a man who, in order that he may the better explore a comparatively unknown region, begins by putting out both his eyes. Interesting analogy, isn't it? That's how you'd explore an unknown region. Put out your eyes. Puts out his eyes, both his eyes, and resolutely refuses the help of the natives to show him the way. This is Trigelis. Why he rejected the testimony of every father of the 4th century except Eusebius, where he was a Gnostic, it were unprofitable to inquire. So that's Trigelis. Lachmann, one or two authorities, Trigelis, rest one or two. Now here's Titchendorf, the third man he's looking at. The last, by far the ablest of the three, knew better than to reject 89/90 of the extant witnesses. He had recourse to the ingenious expedient of adducing, that is, bringing out all the available evidence, but adopting just as little of it as he chose. And he chose to adopt those readings only which are vouched for by the same little band of authorities whose partial testimony had already proved fatal to the decrees of Lachmann and Trigelis. So here's the man that brings them all out, but uses only the few. The other people use the few to start with. Now, summary of the last 3 years. Enough has been said to show the only point we are bent on establishment, that the one distinctive tenet of the three most famous critics since 1831, Now that's the, you ask, we're about the same time frame, see, 1831. This came out 1881, that's 50 years. So it's fairly much similar in time. The one distinct tenet of the three most famous graves since 1831 has been a superstitious reverence for whatever is found. Now remember I said it was worship. James White didn't like it. Superstitious reverence for whatever is found, the same little handful of early, but not the earliest, or yet of necessity the purest documents. Early, but not the earliest. Remember, manuscripts may be the paper, the material on which they're written, may be early material, but the words are not the earliest. The words have been changed. Because the ones that are later and later material, the later, more recent material, but the words go all the way back to the original apostolic words. And furthermore, a little handful early, but not the earliest, that's manuscripts. But the early versions, the early translations, are the earliest words as vouchsafed by the translation they had in their hand, and then the early quotations, the early church fathers. Now, you asked a question before the class, you said, what about the church fathers, and are there any Alexandrian readings? Yes, there certainly are. The men that talk about these things today, our fundamentalist friends that are West Dunmore people and Biennale people, they say that the church fathers are no good, you don't have to use them for anything. And they say there's no church father, some of them say there's no church father, early original or early leader, that has anything to say about the traditional text. All of them are what they call neologian or critical text people. Well, Dean Burgon, that didn't sit too well with Dean Burgon. So he said, well, let's look at them. So in the traditional text that you have in your bookcase there, traditional text, you find on certain page when you come to it, he lists 76 early church fathers that died 400 AD and before. And he said, now what do they use? And he accumulates the whole thing. Of those 76, in a ratio of 4 to 3, 3 to 4 I think it is, 60% to 40% is what it amounts to. You have not only a majority of those church fathers that had in their hands the traditional text, but a majority of 60 to 40%. And the critical texts of his day, people said there weren't even any of those traditional texts in existence prior to 5th or 6th or 7th or 8th centuries. When here Dean Burgon shows very clearly. Dr. Jack Mormon has taken the same church fathers in a current edition, going back and looks at it. He's found not only 60% received text to 40%, 70% to 30% of the church fathers. So those people in this day and age in which we live, the ones that are critical text people, whether fundamentalists or new evangelicals or Roman Catholic, whoever they are, who say there was no Greek traditional text receptus prior to 500 or 600 or 700, are absolutely wrong. If that were true, these early church fathers, 60 or 70% of the quotation couldn't have been from the traditional text, yet those readings are there. And that's where the 86,000 quotations of the early church fathers, quotations or allusions, are in there in the British Museum to this day. Some of the theories, handful but not the early ones, especially the purest documents, errors of the last three theories. And strange, we mentioned, explained, addressing the living representatives of the school of Lachmann, Tregellis, and Tischendorf, strange that you should perceive that you are the dupes of a fallacy which is even transparent. You talk of antiquity, that's old things, but you must know very well that you actually mean something different. You fasten upon three, or perhaps four, or two, or perhaps three, or one, or perhaps two, documents of the 4th or 5th century. Then, confessedly, these three, or one, these one, or two, or three, or four specimens, they are one or two, three specimens only of antiquity. Specimens only of antiquity, not antiquity itself. That's interesting. Specimens, but not antiquity itself. And what if they should even prove to be unfair samples of antiquity, as they are unfair samples of antiquity? Dr. Horn informs us that Lachmann's text of 1831 was the first founded on documentary authority. On what then, pray, does the learned professor imagine the texts of Erasmus, 1516, and of Stoneca, 1522, were founded? His statement is incorrect. The actual difference between Lachman's text and those of the early editors is that his documented authority is partial, narrow, self-contradictory, has proved to be untrustworthy by a free appeal to antiquity. Their documentary authority, that is, these later people in our age, derived from independent sources, though partial and narrow, their authority is independent sources, though partial and narrow, as that on which Lachman relied, exhibits under the good providence of God a traditional text, the general purity of which is demonstrated by all the evidence which 350 years of subsequent research have succeeded in accumulating, and which is confessedly the text of AD 375. So the text and the documentary authority is independent and different from the others. Now, the errors of intrinsic and transcriptional probability. These are big words, but let's look at them. The dissertation on intrinsic and transcriptional probability, which follows, pages 20 to 30, being unsupported by one single instance or illustration we pass by, that ignores throughout the fact that the most serious corruptions of manuscripts are due not to scribes or copyists, but to the persons who employed them. In other words, the scribes are writing things, the people who employed them said, now, when you come to Mark 16, 9 to 20, that's what verse Mark, leave it off. The ones who employed them, so they did. They left them off. And that's what he's saying there. We venture to declare that inasmuch as one expert's notions of what is transcriptionally probable, proved to be diametrically reversed of another expert's notions, to suppose evidence to be derived from the source, may with advantage be neglected altogether. Let me just define intrinsic versus transcriptional, just to be right up front. Intrinsic probability, which is all guesswork, says, what would the original writer have written? That's intrinsic probability. What would Paul have written? What would Peter have written? James, Matthew, Mark, Luke, any of them? How do you know what they would have written? See, Westcott and Hort said we've got intrinsic probability. We think that he would have written this. So by guesswork, that's intrinsic probability. Transcriptional probability. What does Westcott and Hort mean by that? What would the transcriber, the copyist, have likely put down in that Greek word, in that Greek sense? That's transcriptional probability. What would the transcriber have written? Would he have spelled it this way? Would he spell it this way? Another guesswork. They guess in two areas. What the original writer would have written, therefore it's this way, guesswork. What would the transcriber have put down? So another guesswork. What we don't want to deal with these probabilities. We don't know what are the manuscripts telling us. What do the manuscripts say? What is written down, not what they should have written by Paul or Peter, intrinsic probability, or what the transcriber should have transcribed. What did they transcribe? What is there? What is the evidence? That's what he's saying. Let the study of documentary evidence be allowed to take its place. Notions of probability are the very pest of these departments of science which admit of an appeal to fact. Let probability go by the board as the pest of the department. Let the study of documentary evidence be allowed to take its place. High time, however, is it to declare that in strictness, all this talk about genealogical evidence. Now, here's genealogical evidence. When applied to manuscripts, is moonshine. Now, genealogical evidence is the family manuscript theories. They have these families, and that this family is here, this family is here, this family is here, maybe three or four different families. That's the genealogical evidence. They say, well, this reading is from the original family member, and it passes down here, so that's one set of things. That's maybe the family, the Caesarean family. And then maybe there's a family that they call the Alexandrian family. And they've got all these different families. Then they have the Syrian family, which is the Textus Receptus family. They have three different families that are not Textus Receptus. They have one that's Textus Receptus. Three against one. They have these families, genealogical evidence. But he says, let's dispense with genealogical evidence. It's moonshine. In other words, but then it happens, unfortunately, that we are unacquainted with one single instance of a known manuscript copied from another known manuscript. See, genealogy says it copies from this, and they copy from this, and this, right now. That's genealogy, family, the different families. He says, I don't have any knowledge of any one manuscript copied from another. Then he gives some illustrations of that. And perforce all the talk about genealogical evidence, where no single step in the descent can be produced, in other words, there's no genealogical evidence exists, is absurd. Not only moonshine, but absurd. But Dean Burgon disagrees with this intrinsic and transcritical power. It's absurd. But the Westcott North had it. They believed in it. The genealogical evidence, they said, was true. Now, here's an illustration of genealogical evidence. The living inhabitants of a village congregated in the churchyard where bodies of their forgotten progenitors for 1,000 years repose. They lie buried without memorials of any kind. No markers. There they are. How many? Who knows? Maybe 5,000 people, maybe 100, maybe 200 people buried in that cemetery. No markers. And that's a faint image of the relation which subsists between extant copies of the Gospels and the sources from which they were derived. They're unmarked graves. No one knows that this came from this, came from this, came from this. But you see, that's what the critical text people are dependent upon, that genealogical and genealogical evidence does take place, and that's why they can put on that one page of the Nestle-Aland Greek text, which I showed you, 562 different manuscript numbers, plus many others. They treat as only one source, one document, one proof. They do that because they say, oh, that's all this one family. So it's just one vote. That's all they get. It's foolish. There's no such thing. But these other families, the Caesarean family, the Western family, the Alexandrian family, three other families, they just have a handful of manuscripts supplying them. They have B and Aleph and 43 others. They have 43 total in these three families that they concoct. And since they're three different families, three people outvote one. Therefore, the three outvote the 5,210 manuscripts over here, the little 45, because there's three of them and they're families. The false family genealogical evidence that this came from this came from this. Therefore, they say over here that Westcott, the text of Josephus started with a family. And they just copied and copied and copied just like a mimeograph sheet. So just one witness. Now, that's like, to use the illustration of the three men or four men on a desert island. One man is a millionaire. The other three men aren't. How are we going to get this man's money away from him? I have an idea, said one. We'll form a government. And we'll take a vote on it. And so three men said, we want all of the millionaire's money. They got it. Now that's what these manuscripts, three families against one. And it, as Bernstein says, it's moonshine and absurd. There are no such things as genealogical evidence. They're all orphan children. Every manuscript speaks its truth and bears reference to the facts of the matter. It's not copy, 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 copy. They're all independent. That's what he's saying. It's like the graveyard. Now, conflation versus answer. Conflation means a blowing up, elaboration. This is another argument of Westcott and Hort. There's only eight verses alone that are alleged and offered as examples in Westcott and Hort's introduction. Mark 6:33, Mark 8:26, Mark 9:38, Mark 9:49, Luke 9:10, Luke 11:54, Luke 12:18, and Luke 24:53. Now, what they say is you build up and conflate and add to the verses. That's what conflation is. Now, Burgon says that number 1, 2, 5, 6, and 7 don't even exhibit this phenomenon of conflation. You take A plus B equals AB. That's what conflation is talking about. Blowing up, conflating something. A plus B becomes AB. And they say that the text of Josephus is a conflation. They say that A and B were combined and we have AB. We don't believe that. We believe we started with AB. That's the text of Josephus. And the heretics cut off A on one manuscript. They cut off B on another manuscript. And they're all alone, A and B. But AB is the original, not the accumulation of A plus B equals AB. And it's impossible to have these AB solid, when you had A plus B equals AB, if that's the conflation. And then look at all these AB manuscripts. Look at these 5,210 manuscripts, all of which have AB, let's say. How can you get accidentally A plus B equals AB in all these manuscripts? You just accidentally just have to know the truth of the matter is it starts with AB and then they split off. A and split off. That's the difference. That these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 out of the 8 don't even evidence this phenomenon. The interpretation put upon them by Dr. Westcott and Hoare is purely arbitrary, a baseless imagination, a dream, and nothing more. Now there's the false. They say in 250 AD and 350 AD, there's a false text that was made. Horton Westcott wrote the quote, the Syrian text, that is the text receptus, that's another name for the text receptus, the Syrian text must in fact be the result of a recension, must in fact, performed deliberately by editors and not merely by scribes. That's in the introduction. Dean Barbrand answers this, but why must it? Instead of must, in fact, we are disposed to read may in fiction. He doesn't believe it. Before we go further, let's simply say this. Westcott and Hoare had to have a recension theory of the Syrian text or the text receptus. They had to say there was a time, in fact, when it all came together and that it began a beginning. The read had to account of the traditional text. With very few instances of different spellings here, minor things, it was one text. It was like a river. I use as an illustration a river that's gone from this stream, this direction to that direction, 500 feet down the line, it's the same river. 1,000 feet down the way, it's the same river. A mile down, it's the same river, unless pollution comes in. A river of the traditional text, and that's what it is. And they saw this, that these were almost identical, virtually identical manuscripts. They had to find a way, how do we get around this? People are going to believe that that's the true text. Well, we do believe it's the true text. They said, we have that. We've got to make a thing against that thing. How can we explain how all these manuscripts that these people have been worshiping since the 451 Constantine Chalcedon, the Council of Chalcedon, at 451 or 461, whatever the date, how can we explain from that day, from 400 to 1881, that churches have been using these manuscripts? They're all almost identical. We've got to explain that away, because we've got to take care of that. So what we'll do, we'll concoct something. Isn't true, we'll concoct something. That way back in 250 AD and 350 AD, there was a recension or revision, whereby all the people came to one place, they brought their manuscripts, and what they did, they threw out all the Syrian, the Gnostic manuscripts, critical manuscripts, B and Aleph and all that, threw them all out, and just began with theirs. And then it was just like a copy machine from then on, identical reproduction. That's why they're all equal. Now you see, that sounds beautiful, it sounds wonderful. It's not true, there was no such thing as a recension theory, 250 AD or 350 AD, but that's what they had to make up in order to explain away why these were identical. They're identical, or nearly identical, because the churches and the Christians that copied them reverenced the very words of the living God. Copied them exactly, exactly, exactly. New Testament, just like they did in the Old Testament, where they counted all the words in the book, in the Hebrew. So now what about this false so-called Syrian text? Refuted. The learned critic can but mean that on comparing the text of Fathers of the 4th century with the text of Codex B, it becomes to himself self-evident that one of the two has been fabricated. Now notice what he's saying. Here's B and Aleph. Here's the text of the Church Fathers that they had in their hands. They're different. The Church Fathers, 60% of them had the received text, the other 40 quoted from the other text. But the Fathers, basically, here they had a traditional text in their hand, and here you have the Vatican manuscript. They're different. They're kind of different. He said it's obvious, self-evident, that one of the two has been fabricated, made up. Granted, then, why should not the solitary codex be the offending party? Why isn't that the one that's made up? Why not all the hundreds of references of the Church Fathers not be the true one? See, why throw out the baby with the bathwater? Throw out the whole accumulation. Why, we ask, should Codex B be upheld contra mundum. It's a good Latin phrase, against the world. Contra mundum, against the whole world of the manuscripts and so on. And that's his point. Apart, however, from the gross intrinsic improbability of the supposed recension, the utter absence of one particle of evidence, traditional or otherwise, that it ever did take place, must be laid to be fatal to the hypothesis that it did. That's just an hypothesis, this so-called recension. They brought all the manuscripts in, threw out the West Coast Horn manuscripts, Vianello, just retained the traditional text. There's no evidence that it ever took place. It's fatal to the hypothesis that it did. It is simply incredible that an incident of such magnitude and interest would leave no trace of itself in history. Nobody wrote it up. Just think, all the theologians, all the church fathers, all the people from every then known place, from Asia Minor, from Jerusalem, from Egypt, all the places that had the manuscripts come together. Nobody mentions it. Absent from history. Eusebius, various ones, nobody mentioned. No trace of history. As a conjecture, and it only possesses to be a conjecture, professors, Dr. Hort's notion of how the text of the fathers of the 3rd, 4th, and 5th century, which, as he truly remarks, is in the main identical with our own received text, how it came into being must be unconditionally abandoned, this idea, this conjecture, of this recension, 250 or 350 A.D. We've been so full on the subject of this imaginary Antiochian or Syrian text. It's imaginary. Now see, Antioch in Syria, that's why they call the Syrian text, the traditional text, the text receptus, these are all the names for that. We've been full on the subject of the imaginary Antiochian text, not, the reader may be sure, without sufficient reason. Scant satisfaction truly is there in scattering to the winds an airy tissue which its ingenious authors have been industriously weaving for 30 years. But it is clear that with this hypothesis of a Syrian text that is a specially made up recension, that's what he means, the immediate source and actual prototype of the commonly received text of the New Testament, stands or falls their entire textual theory. Now, what he's saying is this. Rush Gunthorpe said they've got to have a recension. You've got to explain by a recension. They came together throughout all the false readings of Vianello. That's how they got the similarity of all these texts. A recension, that's what did it. That has to be the answer. It can't be that that was the original text. It can't be that those are the things that they copied. It was, but they don't believe it. Now notice he says that type of prototype, that false theory of the recension, stands or falls their entire textual theory. Reject it, and the entire fabric is observed to collapse and subside into a shapeless ruin. And with it, the necessity goes this new Greek text. Therefore, the New English Version of our revisions, which is in the main, has been founded upon it. So this recension theory is a very key one. It's false. Now, let me just simply say this. Dean Bergen also, in the book Revision Revised, says, so what if it had happened? What if it were true? What if there was a time when they came together? He said that would be great too. It didn't happen, but what if it did happen? You'd have some of the men from all the then known places of the world bringing their manuscripts. Some of them bringing the original manuscripts in 250 A.D. They had it. That would be the greatest thing in all the world. You could compare them and see, oh, these are true, these are false, throw them out. He said that would be great if it happened. It didn't happen, but that would have been great also. So he uses the argument on either side to show that this is could be true, but it's not true. Now notice the admission of West Gunthorpe that the text receptus is 4th century. Now the men of today, says the text receptus originated in 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th century, 10th century. Never any text receptus in the early days. But Westcott and Hort themselves admit the fundamental text of the late extant Greek manuscripts, that's the text receptus, is beyond all question identical with what Dr. Hort chooses to call the dominant Antiochian or Greco-Syrian text of the second half of the 4th century. the Antiochian and other fathers in the bulk of extant manuscripts written from about 10 to 11 centuries later must have had, in a greater number of the extant variations, a common original either contemporary with or older than our oldest extant manuscripts. This is a quotation from Westcott and Hort's introduction. So they admit that in the 4th century they had the text of Receptus, and that was the one that was the dominant text. And of course they have their false theory of how it came to be dominant, the false recension theory, 250 AD, 350 AD, but at least they admit that it was the text the churches were using. And our brethren today say, well, there's no text of Receptus prior to 600, 700, 800, and that's all late. See, no, it wasn't late. It was early, and even Westcott and Hort admit that that was the text they had. It's an important admission. Now, Burgon agrees on the 4th century date for the TR. So far, then, happily, we are entirely agreed with Westcott and Hort on this date. The only question is, how is this resemblance to be accounted for? Not, we answer, not certainly by putting forward so violent and improbable as irrational a conjecture as that, first about AD 250, and then again about AD 350, an authoritative standard text was fabricated at Antioch, of which all other known manuscripts, except a very little handful, are nothing else but transcripts. But rather by loyally recognizing the practical identity of the text exhibited by 99 out of 100 of our extant manuscripts, the probable general fidelity of those many manuscripts to the inspired exemplars themselves, from which remotely they are confessedly descended. What he's saying here is that we have an irrational conjecture that in 250 AD and 350 they had a standard text that was rescinded and fabricated. He said we don't agree with that at all. We have a text that is exhibited by 99 out of 100 extant manuscripts. Notice the practical identity of the text. That's his word. We change the spellings here and there, but practical identity of these texts, the traditional texts, it's an amazing thing. Yes, Pastor?
I'm curious, where do they come up with these specific dates, 250 and again 350, like there was a revision of the revision? Where do they come up with their specific dates?
Well, they have a man that lived at that time that was supposed to have done it, and they claim that this was a case that they list the man's name. I don't remember exactly what his name was, but the 250 AD was when they had this particular, they claimed that he wrote it. Then in 350 they did it again, some other man, it was allegedly. I don't remember the man's name or the details, but it's a false theory and it didn't happen, but they state that it did. So that's all we can know about that. I'm sure I don't have the names of that. The Lucian recension, there's the name in my mind, Lucian, from Lucian, about 250 AD. They say Lucian was the man in charge of this recension activity. And 250 AD and 350, I don't know what the name of the other one, he came up with one, I'm proud of the two. Lucian recensions. This is certainly not the case. And then, surely, if it be allowable to assume with Dr. Hort that for 1,532 years, namely from 350 AD to 1882, the Antiochian standard has been faithfully retained and transmitted. Now, even Westcott agreed with that. It would be impossible to assign any valid reason why the inspired original itself, the apostolic standard, should not have been as faithfully transmitted and retained for the apostolic age of the Antiochian from AD 90 to AD 250 and 350. In other words, if he says this is the text, Westcott agrees, the 4th century, 350 AD or so was the text of the originals. That's the text that the church used. Why, if they had it from 350 to 1882 preserved, why wouldn't it be preserved from the original up to 350 AD? That's what he's saying. Throughout the interval, less than 250 years, or one-sixth of the period. That's what his argument is. More on this recension there. Doctors Westcott and Hort assume that this Antiochian text, found in the later cursors of the fathers of the latter half of the 4th century, must be an artificial, an arbitrarily invented standard, a text fabricated between 250 and 350. And it may be, and if they may be And if they may but be so fortunate as to persuade the world to adopt their hypothesis, then all will be easy. If they can make the people believe there was this artificial text, everybody got together throughout the B and Aleph types of Gnostic readings, then their hypothesis all would be easy. For then they will have reduced the supposed consent of fathers, the consent of fathers, these church fathers, to the reproduction of one and the same single primary documentary will upset the hypothesis. On the other hand, all is reversed in a moment. Every attesting father is perceived to be a dated manuscript. An independent authority, the combined evidence of several of these becomes simply unmanageable. In like manner, the approximate consent of the cursives, these language, these flowing hand manuscripts, is perceived to be equivalent not to a primary documentary, but to one Antiochian original, but to be tantamount to the articulate speech of many witnesses of high character coming to us from every quarter of primitive Christendom. That's what we have in these documents, not the recension theory, but the primary theories of doctrine. Now, what is Vatican B? How is it described by Dean Burgon? It says, "Behold then the altar at which the copy notice." Now we're going to see there's a sacrifice made. That's an altar where you sacrifice things. You burn them up, you kill them, you slaughter them, you bleed them to death, you hack them with a sword, with a knife, whatever. "Behold the altar at which copies, fathers," that quotation from the church fathers, "versions," those early translations, "are all to be ruthlessly sacrificed." He calls it an altar. Secondly, he calls it a tribunal. There's a judge sitting in his judgment seat. Notice the tribunal from which there shall be absolutely no appeal. Notice the third figure of speech, the oracle, which is to silence every doubt. Three things: an altar to sacrifice the copies, fathers, the virgins; tribunal from which there's no appeal; the oracle, which says silence every doubt, every resolve, every riddle, smooth away every difficulty. All has been stated where the name has been pronounced. Codex B. That's an altar on which sacrificed all the consentient witnesses of manuscripts, quotations of church fathers, and the early transcripts, the early versions. That's the altar. That's the tribunal. B is the tribunal, the judgment. It shuts up every other, silence every doubt, every resolve. And it's the oracle, no appeal. The oracle said, "This is it." B, that's it. And so it's an interesting figure of speech. And then, by unscrupulous use of the process of reiteration, that is repetition, accompanied by a boundless exercise of the imaginative faculty, repetition, imaginative faculty, the mind just dream world, of moonshine, as you said, we have reached the goal to which all that went before has been steadily tending, namely the absolute supremacy of codexes B and Aleph above all other codices. And when they differ, then of codex B. And yet, the immunity from substantive error of a lost codex of imaginary date and unknown history cannot but be a pure imagination, a mistaken one, as we shall present in the present show, of these respective critics, while their proposed practical inference from it, namely to regard the too remote and competitively depraved copies of that original as a safe criterion of genuineness. This, at all events, is the reverse of logical. In the meantime, the presumed proximity of the text of Aleph and of B to the apostolic age is henceforth discoursed as if it were no longer a matter of conjecture. What he's saying is they have an oracle, they have a tribunal, they have an altar on which to sacrifice evidence. They sacrifice truth, they sacrifice historicity, they sacrifice all these things. And if you pronounce the word B, Codex B, all of it falls apart and they worship it. Trying to say that's of apostolic origin, but it's not. The fallacy of worshiping B. Why Vatican and B and Aleph survived? That's another thing. Why did they survive? What is the purpose? What is the course of action that caused them to survive? That's what we want to take up in this particular one. Lastly, we suspect that these two manuscripts are indebted for their preservation solely to their ascertained evil character, which is occasioned that one eventually found its way 4 centuries ago to a forgotten shelf in the Vatican Library. That's B, the Vatican Manuscript. while the other, after exercising the ingenuity of several generations of critical correctors, eventually, namely in 1844, got deposited in the waste paper basket of the convent at the foot of Mount Sinai. Had B and Aleph been copies of average purity, they must long since have shared the inevitable fate of books which are freely used and highly prized. Namely, they would have fallen into decadence and disappeared from sight. Previous veneration of Vatican, since 1881, editors have vied with one another in the fulsomeness of the homage. Remember I said there was worship? And this is what the Imperium says. James White says, oh, don't say worship. We don't worship these manuscripts. The fulsomeness of the homage they have paid to these two false witnesses, for such B and Aleph are, as the concurrent testimony of copies, fathers, and versions abundantly prove. Even superstitious reverence has been claimed for those two codices, and Drs. Westcott and Hort are so far in advance of their predecessors in the servility of their blind adulation that they must be allowed to have easily won the race. Who is the greatest worshiper of B and Aleph? Westcott and Hort. That's what he's saying. Let's stop right here, but do you have any questions before lunch, before we close? If not, let's be dismissed. Have a good lunch. We'll see you back as sharp as we can at 2 o'clock. All right, we're taking up where we left off. Still talking about the West Van Hort's false Greek text. This orange booklet for the summary. We have B and Aleph, but there's superstition involved with the worship there, and they're using them. He says, but when I find them hopelessly at variance among themselves, above all, when I find, number one, all the other manuscripts of whatever date, number two, the most ancient versions, number three, the whole body of the primitive church fathers, decidedly opposed to them, that is, opposed to B, Aleph, and C, I am, to speak plainly, at a loss to understand how any man of sound understanding, acquainted with all the facts of the case, now that's the main word, or main words, with all the facts of the case. You have to have all the facts before you make up a good judgment. Many of our brethren do not have all the facts, or do they want all the facts, but are well acquainted with all the facts and accustomed to exact reasoning. It's another thing that's necessary. Exact reasoning, precise reasoning. All the facts, precise reasoning. How they can hesitate to regard the unsupported or slenderly supported testimony of one or the other of them as simply worthless. The craven homage, now that's worship, isn't it? Which the foremost of the three, that is B, habitually received at the hands of Drs. Westcott and Hort, I can only describe as a weak superstition, something more than unreasonable, becomes even ridiculous. That's a bad name, isn't it? Now you can't conclude a universal from the very few particulars. Berger disagrees that Westcott and Hort can take a very small number of particular examples of antiquity and conclude a universal above all antiquity, about all antiquity. We mentioned that yesterday. We talked about the logic and the generalization, which is the deductive logic. You make the generalization and the particulars, therefore so-and-so. All people are subject to death or mortal. I am one of the people, therefore I am subject to death. That's a generalization. That's from general to specific. And you can't conclude a universal from very few particulars. Inductive reasoning is particular, particular, particular. Therefore, here's the resolution, or the solution, the conclusion of it. But you can't conclude a universal from very few particulars. You have to have a lot of particulars to make them the basis of an induction. Is preposterous. It is not allowable to infer that the universal from the particular. If the bones of Goliath, this is an interesting illustration, were to be discovered tomorrow, would you propose as an induction therefrom that it was the fashion to wear 4 and 20 fingers and toes and one's hands and feet in the days of the giant of Gath? That's a particular, but you can't generalize from that and say all people with 6 fingers, 6 toes, 24 hands. So you can't conclude a universe in very good particulars. Berger disagrees. He says, first of all, he's a first-hand manuscript authority to he examined these manuscripts himself, first judicially, seriously applying ourselves to these studies many years ago. Berger says, we found it wondrous difficult to divest ourselves of prepossessions, rather, very like there are your own. Prepossessions very like your own. Turn which way we would, we were encountered with the same confident terminology. Now, this is the terminology of the Westcott and Ward worshipers. And today, they say that the best manuscripts, primary manuscripts, first-rate authorities, that's what you have, for instance, in the notes of this Old Schofield Reference Bible. The reason we omit Mark 69:20, the best manuscripts say it shouldn't be there. The most ancient manuscripts are the finest. Same work, same reason. First-rate authorities, primitive evidence, ancient readings, and so forth. We found that thereby Codex A or B, Codex C or D were invariably and exclusively meant. It was not until we had laboriously collated these documents that Bergen went through them, word by word, including out for ourselves, that we became aware of their true character. He studied them long before coming to the end of our task, and it occupied us off and on for 8 years. 8 years. We had become convinced that the supposed best documents and first-rate authorities are in reality among the worst. A diligent inspection of a vast number of later copies scattered throughout the principal libraries of Europe and the exact collation of a few further convinced us that the deference generally claimed for B, Aleph, C, and D is nothing else but a weak superstition and a vulgar error, that the date of the manuscript is not of its essence, but is a mere accident of the problem. So he realized after looking at them that these were far from perfect. In fact, they were inferior. Now, Bergen's best and only method. Did he have guesswork? No. We deem this laborious method the only true method in our present state of imperfect knowledge. The method, namely, of adopting that reading, which has the fullest, the widest, and most varied attestation. Antiquity and respectability of witnesses are thus secured. How men can persuade themselves that 19 copies out of every 20 may be safely disregarded, and that's what Westcott and Ward did, they disregarded 19 out of 20, if they be but written in minuscule characters, you know, the smaller characters, we fail to understand. See, Westcott and Ward worshiped the large, the Unschel manuscripts, the old Unschels, Aleph, A, B, C, and D, the old Unschels, the capital letters, they look down their nose at minuscule characters, but how we can throw that away, he says he doesn't understand. To ourselves, it seems simply an irrational proceeding. As for building up a text, as Drs. Westcott and Hort have done, the special superstitious deference, sounds like worship to me, special superstitious deference to a single codex, we deem it about as reasonable as would be the attempt to build up a pyramid from its apex and the expectation that it would stand firm on its extremely and its extremity and remain horizontal forever. You know what a pyramid is, and the apex is the top, the point. If you build that up to the point, it's not going to stand, but that's what they've done with their one manuscript B, and that's the whole thing, building up a pyramid by its apex. Good illustration. Now notice this, the mindset of Westcott and Ward followers. From that day to this, phantoms of the imagination, those are ghosts, phantoms, not real, imagination, that's not real, henceforth usurp the place of substantial forms. Interminable doubt, wretched misbelief, childless credulity, to the B and Aleph being superior, that's childless credulity, judicial blindness are the inevitable sequel and penalty of these phantoms of the imagination. The mind that has long allowed itself to assist in a systematic trifling with evidence is observed to fall the easiest prey to imposture. The mind that has allowed itself systematic trifling with evidence, in other words, forget the evidence, don't wake me up with the evidence, that's easiest to fall prey to imposture or to fraud. It has doubted what is demonstrably true. It has rejected what is indubitably divine. Henceforth, it is observed to mistake its own fantastic creations for historical facts. Now, that's what Westcott and Ward did. Their own dreams, they became reality. That's what he's saying here. To believe things which rest on insufficient evidence or on no evidence at all. No compromise in the battle. Now, there's a professor over there at ABC, the college, Ambassador Baptist College, has written a book. He says, well, let's take both sides. Let's take the Texas Receptus, let's take the Western Critical Text. Let's try to compromise and have friendly relations and everything's fine and so on. He quoted a number of things, a number of times in that book from Westcott and Hort, more so than he did from Dean Burgon. It seems to be a strange situation. He thought that they could be a compromise somehow. Dean Burgon says he can't do it. And that's where the dangers are of some of the schools that are professedly King James and Texas Receptus. They also say, well, there's truth on other sides, and we should have a kind of a compromise and a sort of a mixture, and it really doesn't make much difference, and we don't want to stand the Texas Receptus. Both are all right. See, that's the thing that's a difficult situation. The Rod Bell Seminary and School and College there in North Carolina, he had a school, and he had a video that came out from that school, Tabernacle Baptist College and Seminary, Virginia Beach, Virginia. He came out with a video. Three men spoke in that video. Number one was one of the laymen of the church, had a good talk about their school, what they stood for. Dr. Strauss was then the dean of the student at that time. He's now in Connecticut and doing a good job up there on the Emmanuel Baptist Seminary. And then the third man that spoke on that video for the school was Dr. Rob Bell himself, the president. And Rob Bell said this. He said, as long as I'm pastor, he's no longer pastor because he got into a drinking habit and he resigned of it, and he was a wino and said a little bit for sleeping and so on. After a while, he not only kept it for sleep, but in drinking, he was arrested for many times, unfortunately. But he said, as long as I'm pastor of this church, we'll use the King James Bible, and we'll use the Texas Receptus, the seminary and the college. But then he said this, but there are other good English versions. Stop right there. There are other good English versions. The Ambassador Baptist College man wrote this book trying to tie two cats' tails together, you might say, try to balance it out. It's a similar situation. And when they're not sure, they don't have a strong position. What does Dean Burgon say about a compromise in the battle? Compromise of any sort between the two conflicting parties is impossible also, for they simply contradict one another. Codex B and Aleph are either among the purest of manuscripts, or else they're among the very foulest. The text of Drs. Westcott and Hort is either the very best which has ever appeared, or else it is the very worst. The nearest to the sacred autographs, or the furthest from them. There's no room for both opinions. There cannot exist any middle ground. The question will have to be fought out, and it must be fought out fairly. It must not be magisterially settled. Magisterially settled, as if some king said, this is the way it is. But it must be advocated on either side by the old logical method. The combatants may be sure that in consequence of all that has happened, the public will be no longer indifferent spectators of the fray, for the issue concerns the inner life of the whole community, touches men's heart of hearts. God's truth will be, as it has been throughout, the one object of all our striving. When he says we're going to bring in the people, the lay people, not just these theological, the teachers and professors, that's true. That's been brought in here, and they bring in the lay people. So, but they're teaching many of these churches and colleges, teaching the lay people wrong, and they're deceiving the lay people, saying this the Bible version issue, no problem. Anything you want to do. But combatants have come in from all. No compromise. Hort's own three estimates on the extent of the Greek textual problems between his text and the text Receptus. In 1882, Hort wrote an introduction to the so-called Westcott and Hort Greek text of 1881. His introduction to the New Testament in the original Greek, the text revised by Brooke Cross Westcott and Fenton John Anthony Hort. Hort made an estimate of the differences between various Greek texts. His estimate had three parts. Let me quote each of the parts. Number one, Hort's estimate of the proportion of the Greek New Testament that was virtually accepted by everyone. We don't agree with his proportions, and that's just out of his head, but here's what he said. He wrote, with regard to the great bulk of the words of the New Testament, as of most other ancient writings, there's no variation or other ground of doubt, therefore no room for textual criticism. The proportion of words virtually accepted on all hands is raised above doubt is very great. not less than a rough computation, than 7/8 of the whole. The remaining eighth, therefore, formed in great part by changes of order and other comparative trivialities, constitutes the whole area of criticism. So he says 7/8 is all right. There's 1/8 left. That's what he said. That's the first part. Since the whole in numbers of Greek words and pages in the Greek New Testament, as seen in the table above, we had a table there, 140,521 Greek words, 100% is 647 pages. Quote 7/8 of the Greek New Testament, virtually agreed by all, would be 122,956 Greek words, 87.5%, or 566 pages. Now, Hort's 1/8 of the New Testament, Greek New Testament, he claimed was in dispute, would be 17,565 Greek words, 12.5%, 81 pages. In point of fact, as seen in the above table, I don't put the table here, but it's in the book, I guess, as seen in the above table, the area of dispute between the Westcott and Hort Greek text, as opposed to the text receptors that underlies the King James Bible, is only 9,970 Greek words, or 7%. 45.9 pages if you put them all together. So Hort's estimate in this area is incorrect. He says it's 12% that in dispute, but we have 7%. So that's a difference of opinion we have. Number two, Hort's estimate of the portion of the Greek New Testament that would still be in doubt if his principles were followed. He says if the principles followed in the present edition are sound, then they're not sound, they're not unsound. This area may be very greatly reduced, recognizing to the full the duty of abstinence from peremptory decision in cases where the evidence leaves the judgment in suspense between two or more readings. We find that setting aside differences of orthography or spelling, the words in our opinion still subject to doubt only make up about 1/60th of the whole New Testament. 1/60th. So we've got 1/8, now 1/60th. That's what he's saying. Well, let's see if we can figure that out. Since the whole in numbers of Greek words is 140,000 plus 647 pages, Hort's 1/60th would still subject to doubt if his principles were followed. It would be 2,342 Greek words, 1.6%, 11.4 pages in the Greek New Testament, put all in one place. But we don't follow Hort's principles at all. Because of this, we hold that Greek texts that underlies the King James Bible are still disputing 9,970 Greek words. Actually, now it's 8,000 if you do a conductor Norman's study, rather than only 2,342 Greek words. This represents 7% of the Greek words rather than only 1.7%, or 45.9 pages rather than 11 pages. So Hort's estimate in this area is incorrect again. We still maintain that the Greek words in dispute are vastly more in number than Hort has stated. He says if you follow our principles, all these things disappear. We don't follow his principles. All these canons of criticism, as it were. Well, here's number three. Here's Hort's estimate of the course of the Greek New Testament that contains substantial variation. He wrote this, quote, in the second estimate, the proportion of comparatively trivial variations is beyond measure larger than the former. So that the amount of what can in any sense be called substantial variation is but a small fraction of the whole residuary variation. It can hardly form more than a thousandth part of the entire text. So he goes from 1/8 to 1/60th, now to 1,000th. That's all we have to worry about is 1,000th. Trivial variation. All right, how do we size that up? Well, the whole would be 140,000 Greek words, 647 pages. The 1/1,000th substantial variation would be 140 Greek words. That's 0.1%. That's 0.6 of a page. That's a little over half a page. All we have to worry about is a little over half a page. Well, if you looked at Mark 16:9-20, that's over half a page in and of itself. Then you take the woman taken in adultery, John 7:53-8:11. That's another 12 verses. You see how crazy, if his principles are followed, see, he has no problem with Mark 16:9-20. Take it out. No problem with a woman taking adultery. Take it out. See, if his principles are followed, he has just very little to worry about. But that's quite a difference. This would be a little over one half of a page. Now, Greek New Testament, that's extremely wide of the mark of truth, since we don't follow Hort's principles at all. Greek texts that underlies the King James Bible are still disputing substantial variation, 9,900 Greek words, 7%, 45.9 pages. If it is Hort's last estimate, it has been seized on by the modern day puppets and grossly distorted in order to fool people into thinking that the problem is very tiny and in reality it's much, much larger. This is what they say in the popular university books. This is what they talk about. Don't worry about the differences. Don't worry about the range. There's less, a little over half a page of difference between these two texts. Well, let me ask you something. How can a little over half a page take up 8,000 differences? Can you let me understand that? 8,000, that's 500 plus large pages. That Dr. Jack Mormon has chaptered and versed on. He's not making up a wild, wild guess like Hort and Westcott, like the other friends that are enemies in this subject, and say, just let's go over half a page. That's what they're saying. They don't know it. They don't research it. I wish they'd get busy and look into it. Maybe they could agree on some things that we agree on if they would do that. The estimate proportion of Greek Testament is substantial variation. Hort's pupils, now these are the pupils of the fundamentalists, many of them, Bible believing Christians that follow Hort. Hort's pupils are either knowingly or unknowingly misquoting their teacher. They want to make the differences in the Greek text very, very slight so as to minimize the arguments against the false Westcott and Hort Greek text. From the above quotations from Hort's introduction, that's what we've reproduced, the Bible for today. We don't agree with it, we reproduced it. His differences in the Greek text would either be 81 pages, that's 1/8, or 11.4 pages, that's 1/60, or 6/10 of one page, or 1/1000, rather than merely a little over 1/2 of a page. That would be merely a little. Hort's 1/8, the total differences would amount to 81 pages. In reality, we're faced with 45 pages. So the whole thing is different in these ways. A current illustration of this practice of distorting the facts in this area is found in a tape recorded message given by Dr. Kenneth Barker. He's the chairman of the NIV translation. Dr. Barker spoke in the Sunday evening service, September 12, 1993, at the Southside Baptist Church, Greenville, South Carolina. A friend recorded the message and gave me a copy. Dr. Barker stated this: there are over 5,000 Greek manuscripts. That's true. In 1967, 5,255. Now, 200-300 more. That's true. So, notice then he says, and all of them are agreed 98% of the time. That's not true. So all of this debate that Carson, D.A. Carson, refers to in the King James Version debate, all of this debate, all of this hullabaloo, as he says, is over less than 2% the entire text of the New Testament. And that less than 2%, you can select any reading that you wish among the manuscripts. That's not our approach, but you can. And it won't change Christian doctrine one bit. So you see, here's no doctrine, 2%, falsehood. Then Dr. Barker's wrong on two counts. I said less than 2% difference between any of the Greek manuscripts would be 2,810 Greek words, 12.9 pages. The truth of the matter, 7% differences, and that's a lot different than those words. This would be 9,970 Greek words, 45.9 pages, not 12, but 45.9. If you put them all together, this is the most serious error. It's blatant falsehood. It's being promulgated by the chairman of the New International Version Translation Committee. Give false confidence to the pastor and members of this church that have just recently given up the King James Bible in favor of Dr. Barker's NIV. This church where he spoke, Southside Baptist Church in Greenville, has thrown out the King James Bible and has introduced the NIV of Kenneth Barker. The second serious error of Dr. Barker's statement, relative to the fact that variation in the manuscripts won't change Christian doctrine one bit. In our book, we specify 158 such passages, chapter 5. We mentioned that before. Dr. Mormon lists 356 such passages, doctrinal passages. These two falsehoods, from someone who should know better, are the major ones used to lull Bible-believing Christians into deep slumber concerning the Bible verse and controversy that had been raging. It's a sad thing. I guess we're finished with this, so I guess I better go to the next one. Okay. Let's see if I get out of here. We go into the next page, which is a brief summary, I believe, of the traditional text. Let's see if I can get out of here. We can keep it. Do you have any comments, questions on this before we go to the next one? Yes, go ahead, Dave.
Okay.
By the way, I've asked the secretary of Mr. Ramaphosa to give me a roster. I still haven't got a roster. I'd like all your names, addresses, phone numbers, emails, and so on. Keep track of you and so on, and be able to call the roll. I don't even know who the roll is. See, Steve was going to get that for me this morning, but apparently he wasn't able to do so. Go ahead. What's your question? Go ahead.
Okay. I just had a question. Ford is claiming that's only less than 2%.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Right.
Now, what is he doing with the other percentage, the other 5% that he claims, that we claim, he is not verifying that it exists? You follow what I'm saying? He claims only 2%, but we claim 7% mm-hmm. difference. What is he doing with that other 5%? Is he just not saying it's kind of another carpenter?
Well, I don't think he knows that there's a 7%. He just, out of the clear blue sky, I think he's basing it on Westcott and Hort's estimate. I think that's probably those figures that Westcott and Hort said. Is that 2%? I don't remember all the details. I don't know what he does. I really don't know. I wish I did know. Yes, Pastor?
You know, I find it interesting that on one hand they say we've got a superior text. Mm-hmm. They argue that the TR is a poor text of mistakes and that. But then they flip-flop around and say, but we're not very far from it.
Mm-hmm.
They argue on one side, we've got a better text. This is a better, and I hear this from the NIV. This is a much better, but then you say, well, it's got errors. Well, we're really not all that far from the King James.
Not too many variations. That's what they're saying. That's what's a better text. Because the whole argument among the fundamentalists has shifted. When Dr. Kirk and his partner, and I and my partner, debated in 1980, however many years before it was, 26 years ago, 25, whatever, when we debated was Nestle-Aland Greek text versus text that has a King James Bible. Pure and simple. Reasons why theirs is superior, why ours is superior. Now the thing has changed. They don't argue anymore about that. We believe the Word of God is preserved. The Word, meaning the message, thoughts, and forget the words. Don't worry about the words. Just agree with us and preserve His message, His thoughts, and ideas. Hadn't preserved His words, not words. Just the message is up. That's the fundamentalist consensus. And that's why these last two books we're talking about, Thursday, Friday, have been recently done. The lies they tell about the preservation of the Scripture. That's the sad thing. I would a whole lot rather debate somebody that honestly believes, like Dr. Custer, that the Nestle-Aland text is the closest to all. At least there's something with it. But when you throw away and don't even talk about it, then just say it's the meaning message, thoughts, and ideas, and don't even discuss the details to combat. Which I knew what he did with the other percent, but I don't even know how he got the 2%, personally. Let's go to the other book, The Cause of Corruption. Is that the number? I think that's the number. That looks like this gray one here. The Cause of Corruption of the Traditional Text by Dean Burgon. And it's a brief summary that Dean Burgon died before the traditional text.
You mentioned the preservation. Does the manuscripts that they use, mm-hmm. what does it do with the words in Psalm 12, 6, and 7? In plurality, or is it still in the singular form?
Well, in Psalm 12, 6, and 7, they say they go right along with the NIV, which usurps a word and says that the preserved, keep them and preserve them. They changed keep them and preserve them to keep us and preserve the people. And so they go right along with the NIV. That is nothing in the Hebrew. There's a footnote on the Hebrew Bible. The Septuagint doesn't have us, preserve us. But they don't say that of the words. They say that's something else. It just talks about the people being preserved. The context clearly indicates to me, it says the words of the Lord are pure. Furnace fire purified seven times. Thou wilt keep them, preserve them, going back to the words. It just talked about the words. How do you get the people? See, verse 6 and verse 7 must be continuous. And the antecedent for a pronoun is the closest noun. The closest noun is the words. And that chomp. So they say it doesn't apply. They say none of the verses that we use for preservation of the words of Scripture apply. None of them. Not even the Lord's words. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. So they don't dispute the word versus word, but they say in their preservation issue that word of God means different than the words of God. Okay. All right, let's go to the, yes, Pastor.
I think we should be on the traditional text.
Okay, got the wrong one then. Okay, well, I wondered about that. Let me just get out of here then. I was thinking about we should be on the traditional text. All right, let's go to the traditional text. We hadn't come to this yet. All right, traditional text is next. Like that, right? Thank you for straightening that out. I didn't want to get on the wrong base. Traditional text, absolutely. Right, this is also dedicated and established. Now, someone, one of the students asked earlier, why is it traditional text volume 1 and cause of correction volume 2? It's because Dean Burgon died before these were produced, and Edward Miller combined Dean Burgon's notes into two different texts, the traditional text, volume 1, that cause of corruption, but they're all one unit that Dean Burgon, it was published posthumously by Edward Miller. Then Dean Burgon's legacy, the death of Dean Burgon, 1888. Remember, I didn't know the day of his death, it's 1888. I thought it was 1888. Cut him off in the early part of the task for which he had made preparation during more than 30 years, working on this whole thing, defending the words of God, studying assiduously, closely. Examined manuscripts widely, making many discoveries at home and in foreign libraries, collated some himself and got many collated by other scholars, encouraged new and critical editions of some of the chief versions. Above all, he devised and superintended a collection of quotations from the New Testament as he found in the words of the fathers and other ecclesiastical writings, going far beyond the ordinary indexes, which may be found in 16 thick volumes, 16 folio volumes. Amongst the treasures of the British Museum, 86,000 plus quotations, 16 folio volumes, thick volumes. Divine Bible preservation. There exists no reason. Now, here's Dean Burgon's position on the preservation of the Bible, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek words. There exists no reason for supposing that the divine agent, who in the first instance thus gave to mankind the scriptures of truth, straightway abdicated his office, took no further care of his work, abandoned those precious writings to their fate. He doesn't believe that was what God intended. If it's verbally plenarily inspired and God breathed, it's verbally plenarily preserved. That's the stand of our brethren over in Singapore. Praise God for them. They're Chinese Christians. They take VII, verbal inspiration of Scripture, VPI, verbal preservation.
Verbal plenary inspiration, verbal plenary preservation.
All right, verbal plenary inspiration. All right, VPI, that's good. Couldn't get into these letters. VPI, verbal plenary inspiration, verbal and plenary, full and verbal, the words. And VPP, verbal plenary preservation, the words. Talking not about the King James Bible words, the Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek words. Verbal plenary preservation. That's the position that we take, that the Dean Burgon Society takes over in Singapore. The Bible has been preserved. Two rival New Testament textual schools. Indeed, there exist but two rival schools of textual criticism. And these are irreconcilably opposed, as Dean Burgon says. No compromise. In the end, one of them will have to give way and vae victus, may the victor live. Unconditional surrender will be its only resource. When one has been admitted to be of the right, there can be no place for the other. It will have to be dismissed from attention as a thing utterly, hopelessly in the wrong. That's why the gentleman from Vassar Baptist College is dead wrong in trying to tie these two fighting things together. He can't do it. If one is right, the other is wrong. And to have an agnostic position, we don't know for sure. Now, that's a serious thing. And students coming out of that school, I don't care whether they use the Textus Receptus or the King James Bible, if they're taught to be agnostic about which is right, that's almost far more difficult than a person coming out of Bob Jones saying that the Textus Receptus is wrong and their critical text is right. That at least you can fight that clean cut, but one that's in the dark about it, it's a very serious situation. When one has been admitted to be the right, there can be no place found for the other. They will have to be dismissed in the test and utterly hopelessly in the wrong. Now, Dean Burgon has seven tests of truth. I proceed to offer for the reader's consideration seven tests of truth. Where these seven tests are found to conspire, we may confidently assume that the evidence is worthy of all acceptance and is to be implicitly followed. Our reading should be attested then by the seven following notes of truth. These are good notes of truth. Number one, antiquity or privileges. If you can find antiquity, that's fine. Closest to the old. Consent of witnesses or number. That's what we have in our text receptors. And variety of evidence or catholicity, variety. All different kinds of evidence. Manuscripts, versions, Church Fathers quotations. Respectability of witnesses or weight. Continuity, unbroken tradition. That's what we have, continuity from the apostolic age to the present. The other side doesn't have continuity. Evidence of the entire passage or context, internal considerations or reasonableness. So these are the seven notes of truth. The more ancient testimony is probably, antiquity is the first one. The more ancient testimony is probably the better testimony, that it is not by any means always so is a familiar fact. It's not always true. To quote the known dictum of a competent judge, that's Dr. Scrivener, it is no less true to fact than paradoxical and sound that the worst corruptions to which the New Testament has ever been subjected originated within 100 years after it was composed. We've quoted this before, earlier this morning, that Irenaeus and the African fathers of the whole Western, the portion of the Syriac church, used far inferior manuscripts. Those are the ancient ones. Those were closer to the original. Inferior measures to those employed by Seneca or Erasmus or Stevens 13 centuries after when molding the text receptors. Therefore, antiquity alone affords no security that the manuscript in our hands is not infected with corruption, which sprang up largely in the first and second centuries. Now, that is the reason that antiquity alone is the oldest, the best, can't hold water, because of the infection of corruption of the heretics that changed these Gnostic heretics. Seven testers, number. Now, we had antiquity. Now, number is the most ordinary ingredient of weight. Indeed, in the matters of human testimony, is an element which even cannot be cast away. Ask one of Her Majesty's judges if it be not so. Here's his illustration. 10 witnesses, suppose, are called in to give evidence, of whom one resolutely contradicts what is solemnly deposed by the other 9. Which of the two parties do we suppose the judge will be inclined to believe? The 1 or the 9? Witnesses. And these are people that have seen something. See, so this is the number. And this is why it's important to see that the traditional text that underlies the King James Bible, with its over 99% of the weight, over 5,210 plus against the less than 1% of the 45, is strong number. Where did they get that? They got it because it was true from the original. They copied and copied and copied. That's the number. The third thing, variety. What does that mean? Witnesses of different kinds, from different countries, speaking different tongues, witnesses who can never have met. See, this is variety. And between whom it is incredible that there should exist collusion of any kind. Such witnesses deserve to be listened to most respectfully. Indeed, when witnesses are of so varied a sort, agree in large numbers, they must needs be accounted worthy of even implicit confidence. So variety, antiquity, number, not variety. Suddenly here's variety again. It is precisely this consideration which constrains us to pay supreme attention to the combined testimony of the uncials, those are capital letter manuscripts, the whole body of the cursives, the flowing hand manuscripts. They are dotted over at least 1,000 years. Over 1,000 years, these copies are. B, they evidently belong to so many diverse countries. This is variety. Greece, Constantinople, Asia Minor, Palestine, Syria, Alexandria, and other parts of Africa. Not to say Sicily, southern Italy, Gaul, England, and Ireland. That's variety. And these are the manuscripts. Not just B and Aleph, which have no variety whatever. They're only coming from one place, from Egypt and Alexandria. C, they exhibit so many strange characteristics and peculiar sympathies. D, they so clearly represent countless families of manuscripts, being in no single instance absolutely identical in the text, certainly not being copies of other codex in existence, of any other codex, that the unanimous decision I hold to be an absolutely irrefragable evidence of the truth. So variety. different countries, different styles, different ages, different dates. That's important. Different languages. Now, there's another test, respectability or weight. In the first place, the witnesses in favor of any given reading should be respectable. Respectability is, of course, a relative term, but its use and applicability in this department of science will be generally understood and admitted by scholars, although they may not be altogether agreed as to the classification of their authorities. So respectability, or weight. The next one is continuity. This is a very important test of truth. When, therefore, a reading is observed to leave traces of its existence and of its use all down the ages, it comes with an authority of a peculiarly commanding nature. And, on the contrary, when a chasm of greater or less breadth of years yawns, it's an interesting word, yawns, opens its mouth, in the vast mass of evidence which is ready for employment, or when a tradition is found to have died out, which of course the critical text has done, upon such a fact alone, suspicion or grave doubt or rejection must inevitably ensue. And so the chasm, great years of change, and leave traces of existence. So this is continuity, and our text of receptors has continuity from 37 tests of or continuity of acceptance of the churches, as we mentioned there earlier, and the other one doesn't. It stops at 450, 500, 600 AD and stops, and there's no continuation of that. And then, still more, when upon the admission of the advocates of the opinions which are opposing, the chasm is no longer restricted but engulfs not less than 15 centuries in its hungry abyss. In other words, here, no continuity for 1,500 years, 1,500 years. No continuity between B and L from the critical text and today. That's no continuity. That's a yawning chasm, he said. Well, that engulfs the loss of 15 centuries in its hungry abyss, or else then the transmission ceased after four centuries. That's exactly what happened. It ceased. They no longer copied it. They knew it wasn't true. They didn't want to copy it. It's evident that according to this essential note of truth, those opinions cannot fail to be self-destroyed, as well as to labor under condemnation during more than three-quarters of the accomplished life of Christendom. Now, that's an interesting thought, isn't it? The hungry abyss and the no continuity, that's a strong test of truth. This context now is not as important as some of the others. A word, a phrase, a clause, or even a sentence or paragraph must have some relation to the rest of the entire passage, which precedes or comes after it. Therefore, it will often be necessary in order to reach all the evidence that bears upon a disputed question to examine both the meaning and the language living on both sides of the point in dispute. Now, Dean Burgon didn't think 1 John 5, 7 particularly was adequate, but our man on this side of the ocean have stood for that, 1 John 5, 7, and 8, and we believe they are genuine. One of the facts that leads us to believe that, not only the fact that though there were not as many Greek manuscripts that have 1 John 5, 6, and 7, 5, 7, and 8, but there are hundreds of Latin manuscripts that carry it, and there's a division in the Greek Orthodox Church, as one of the authors has stated, whereby the head man of the Greek Orthodox Church denied the Trinity, and he was an Arian, and as such he could have called in some of those Greek texts, but the Latin Church, the Western Church, had no problem with the Trinity, and so hundreds of manuscripts are there. But regardless of manuscript evidence, 1 John 5, 7, and 8, many have looked at the internal evidence, the context, and the grammatical context. When you have the genders, masculine genders going with masculine, the feminine going with feminine, and you look at the pronouns, you look at the participles in 1 John 5, 7, and 8, and if you take out 5, 7, 8, the portion that is missing in the modern version, the syntax, the grammar, doesn't fit. You leave it in, and it does fit. So this is an idea of a context that would bear on that point of dispute. Then internal evidence. That's another one. It's not as strong as others. It's more subjective. According to the true reading, a passage must be ascertained, with very slight exception indeed, from the preponderating weight of an external evidence. That's the most important, external evidence. Just according to its antiquity, to number, to variety, relative value, continuousness, with the help of the context. Internal considerations, unless in exceptional cases are found in strong opposition to evident error have only a subsidiary force. So the internal evidence is not a strong test of truth, but it is one of the tests. Here's the traditional text ratio. Remember you asked about what was the ratio of the church fathers that had the traditional text. Ratio of 3-2. It might have had another ratio we had talked about, but 3-2 is what it is. No one, I believe, has till now made a systematic examination of the quotations occurring in the writings of the fathers who died before AD 400 and in public documents written prior to that date. The testimony, therefore, of, and he has 76 of early fathers, these church fathers are either quoted the scripture or alluded to the scripture, is emphatically according to the issue of the numbers in favor of the traditional text being about 3-2. That'd be 60% to 40%, 3-2. That's exactly what it is. But it is also necessary to inform the readers of this treatise that here quality confirms quantity. Quality confirms quantity. A list will now be given of 30 important passages. This is your traditional text now. That's what you quoted in Bergen's quote. So study that if you have a question. A list will now be given of 30 important passages in which evidence is borne on both sides. And it will be seen that 530 testimonies are given in favor of the traditional readings as against 107 on the other side. In other words, the traditional text beats its opponent in general proportion 3-1 in these particular 30 important passages. As far as the fathers who died before 400 AD are concerned, the question may be now put in answer, do they witness to the traditional text as existing from the first, or do they not? The results of the evidence, both as regards the quantity and quality of the testimony, enable us to reply not only that the traditional text was in existence 400 AD and before, but that it was predominant during the period under review. And not only predominant, but 3-2 ratio, 60% to 40%. Let anyone who disputes this conclusion make out for the Western text, or the Alexandrian, or the text of Bein Ali, a case from the evidence of the fathers which can be equal or surpass that which has now been placed before the reader. In other words, the evidence is there. The preponderance. The men today, as I said before, the fundamental believers, many of them on the other side of this issue, say that we don't have any evidence at all that the traditional text, Text Receptus, was in evidence in the early days. Only it began 600, 700, 880. It began there. Well, if it began over there, how can 3-2 ratio have these early church fathers, 76 that died 400 AD and before, how can it have that percentage of quotations from received text words, Text Receptus words? There's all kinds of different, but it's impossible to. So, being out of the, you can't have this thing from the fathers of the other side. They can't equal or surpass the percentage of 3-2. They're down 40%, the others 60%. As I said before, Dr. Jack Mormon has done the study on a current basis, and he's got 70% traditional text and 30% of the so-called neologian text, or Wishcott Horton text, in his study. Why no earlier traditional manuscripts? That's the question. Talking about Bein Ali. How is it that we possess no manuscripts of the New Testament of any considerable size older than those? Or at least no other such manuscript as old as they are? Besides the disastrous results of the persecution of Diocletian, he killed the Christians, took their Bibles, and burned them. There is much force in the reply of Dean Burgon that being generally recognized as bad manuscripts, they were left standing in the shelf in their handsome covers, whilst others, which were more correct, were being thumbed to pieces in constant use. That's one reason why they still existed. Wouldn't a book exist very fine in a library such as this? And that's what happened to the Vatican libraries. Would it exist as far as the Sinai and the monastery? Kept, not used, not thumbed, not turned and twisted, and so on. And if you've ever seen your first Bible, if you were a student of the Bible, as I was when I was first saved, I read that thing, why the thing is in tatters. I still have it somewhere, I don't know where it is, but use does make wreak havoc upon pages. A later manuscript is better than old, then it will be found, as I'm bold enough to say, that in many instances, a 14th century copy of the Gospels, exhibit the truth of Scripture, while the 4th century copy in all these instances proved to be the depository of a fabricated text. You see what he's saying? Age is not the consideration. 14th century copy of the Gospels, better than the 4th century copy. See, if the ancient, the age, the older the best, how can you come up with that conclusion? We're talking now not about the substance on which the words are written. That can be older. But the words themselves of these more recent copies are older than the other. And they can be proved to be older by the early versions and by the early quotations of the church fathers. But that's what he's saying there. We're going to pause right here for a 10-minute break. But do you have any comments or questions before we do? If not, what? Take 10. We'll see you in 10 minutes. Thank you.